Okay. The idea is students then will help transcribe, and it'll be part of the research methods class.
Okay.
So that's why it's really important to have it taped.
Yeah.
So how did you get, what was your major in college? How did you get involved in this?
My major was sociology.
Oh, super.
Yeah, that was sociology.
Uh-huh.
And my undergraduate degree.
Mm-hmm.
And then I told you I have a degree in public administration.
Mm-hmm.
And actually I was focused on healthcare because I then went to work for Hutchings Psychiatric Center and was in their adolescent children's division,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
I helped administer that program. And then I went to law school, and I served as a time as a lawyer.
What led you to make the switch?
Not really. I detested working for the state of New York.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I just mm-hmm. could not stand working for the state of New York.
Mm-hmm.
It was oppressive to me.
Mm-hmm.
Working for the state in that bureaucracy rewards people who are not rule breakers. They're not creative. They're followers. They're people who and I particularly was frustrated with the unions because I saw people who were very, very bad at the jobs they were doing,
mm-hmm.
and who were protected and were kept on and in their positions, and they shouldn't have been.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't see. I saw people, many, many, many people who wanted to do good, and I count myself as one of those. I'm not sure in the end that the system allowed us to do good.
Mm-hmm.
And I could not, you know, when I thought about spending my entire career in this New York State system in mental health, I just didn't want to do that anymore.
So you were an administrator?
I was an administrator.
Administrator.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I just didn't want to do that anymore. It's mm-hmm. not something mm-hmm. that I wanted to do. It didn't hold my interest, and my passion was mm-hmm. dwaning. It was definitely draining out of me. And because so much of your time when you're in these large bureaucracies is spent on maintaining your position in the bureaucracy, and it's not working towards the goals of the organization. You know, it's trying to do this and stay on top and go to the next level and all this other bullshit, which mm-hmm. did not interest me.
Mm-hmm.
It really didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So, frankly, and looking back on it, quite honestly, I don't think I was that good of an administrator. I just don't.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I've got great qualities for an administrator.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to law school, I think perhaps maybe not knowing what else to do.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to say that. But honestly, I've always been interested in cities. That's why I went to urban planning school in the first place.
So you did that right after the MPA? Or?
Yeah. No, the MPA, and then I worked for probably 7 or 8 years.
Did you do the MPA right after undergrad?
No. I worked for a couple of years between. I worked in social services.
Mm-hmm. So as a sort of a social worker?
Yeah, social worker mm-hmm. person, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was down in Washington for a little while. And
what were you doing there?
I worked for, actually, I went there to follow a girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up working for the U.S. Postal Service and their headquarters and their economic development division, which was totally bizarre. it was another example of a government agency, and it absolutely convinced me that I did not want to work for the government.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came back and I came back to work on the McGovern campaign. I did that, and then I went to school at Maxwell, got that degree, and then I went to work at Hutchings, and I worked at Hutchings, and then I went to law school after that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I certainly have not had a very straight path in terms of my career, in terms of my professional career. But having said that, I've ended up in a place that I absolutely love and I never want to retire from.
Mm-hmm.
So I think any time I lost at the beginning, I'll probably gain at the end,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because I have really no intention to retire. And I really do love my work, and I love this, and I think that cities, you know, I've never done anything outside of a city, and I don't plan to. I might do something inside of a town or a village, but you'll never find me doing any work in a suburban shopping center or anything like that. And I do think cities are critically important, and I think that we've kind of lost our way. And I think the little bit that I do helps for people to understand why cities, you know, are great, and how they can add to people's lives, you know, how they improve people's lives.
How was it that you became enamored with cities? I'm from Brooklyn originally. It reminds me of my great.
That's a good question, Frank. And I came from a very small town. Mm-hmm. I came from Kirkland? A very small Dowdsville, New York. It was a little farming town. Mm-hmm. I went to school with a lot of farmers. Mm-hmm. But I became very, very taken as I was, you know, in college and beyond. I became very taken with the idea of community and togetherness, and feeling that this kind of human interaction was very important to me. It was very important to me. And for me, believe it or not, my concept of a city never got that far away from Dowdsville. It really didn't.
Because were you in a city in college?
I was here.
Oh, you're in.
I was in Lemoyne.
Oh, you were at Lemoyne.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It really never got that far away because even though I love big cities, and I do, and I love all the cities around the world that I can tell you about, but I conceive of them as places where people are able to find if they choose to. Are able to find a community. I really do. And that's, in many ways, I don't, and when we were doing Armory Square, that's what I conceived of. I conceived of that. In fact, when people would talk to me about Armory Square and about the people who were on the street, and these were people who were probably released from Hutchings in some cases or whatever, I thought back to growing up in Dowdsville, and we had people who were mentally quite disturbed, but who somehow we integrated them somehow into this little community. We did. They were, now, do I think that they were necessarily treated with as much dignity or whatever as they should have been or could have been? Probably not, but you know what? In reflection upon it, I am convinced that the human contact that those people received in Dowdsville was probably more important than any quote professional services that they could have received. I really do believe that. And I said, and so getting back to what people would say to me about these people on the street, and I said, you know, I would say to them, it's not the people who are on the street that are of the concern. It's the people who are not on the street that are the concern. That's because the people on the street are part of the fabric. The problem that you're experiencing is that they're the only threads that you're seeing. If the rest of the fabric is filled in, then they will become part of it. And you know what? That's exactly what happened. As Armory Square began to fill in, some of the people there, and I can show them to you right today, although you probably will not, I'd have to point them out to you, but I can show you the people who, some of whom were there when I started.
Really?
Now they have gray beards, but they still wash windows, and they're on part of some social service program somewhere, which I don't know where it is, but you know what? Everybody knows their name. And they interact with people. And I think that to me, I think is that's a big part of what it's about. It's a big part of what it's about.
And now you've got a bunch of buildings there, right?
Yeah.
Now, was the Armory itself there the most? Was that there when you started?
The Most wasn't there.
Most
the Armory was there.
Yeah,
the building was there, but mm-hmm. obviously, but the Most was in a little building on Clinton Street. It was mm-hmm. just a little mm-hmm. teeny building,
mm-hmm.
probably only 2,500 square feet.
Okay.
And Steve Caron is really the guy who did all that stuff and moved it over to the Most. Now. He's a case of a, I think of another case of an entrepreneur in a way, is in that he was good at all this getting started stuff, the concept, but he, when he got to running this expanded organization, he lacked some of the skills. I shouldn't say his name, but he lacked some of the skills, and that's when the thing started to go downhill. Mm-hmm. But he was really he really should be given credit, and I think his picture hangs somewhere in the Most, and it should, because mm-hmm. he really was the guy who really pushed the thing forward. But so that it was there, but it was small, mm-hmm. very small.
So now you did Pasta Abilities, that building, the nice Temple of Labor, and then did you move on to something down the street?
No, we moved on to the building right next door.
Oh, okay.
It was called the Hogan Block,
mm-hmm.
And then we did another building called these all had names. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but they did the Seneca Building, and then the Mill Pond Landing Building, and we did another small building over on Walton Street.
One has the arcs now. Yeah, it has all the sort of the it's sort of art. It's also kind of I'm trying to remember from
Eureka?
The tour. Yeah, is it Eureka Crafts?
I didn't have that. They were Eureka Studios was there before I was.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they were there. They were originally located on a floor in the Bentley Center Building.
Mm-hmm.
And they were there. There was a couple of things that were there before we began. They were one of them. There was a whole grain bakery called Our Daily Bread, which was there, and it was a fabulous bakery.
Uh-huh.
Went on. It was really a wonderful bakery.
Mm-hmm.
so they were there. And then Eddie Butler came in and opened up this bar restaurant place. And then we sort of arrived on the scene. And I think that what we, George and I, brought to the whole thing was a structure
mm-hmm.
as to how this thing was, and then, we gathered a group called the Armory Square Association, and we helped build that, not with tremendous amounts of help from other people. And mm-hmm. as part of the early startup, I have some photographs which are very funny, but, we would hold these events that were, like, goofy. And we had chicken barbecues in the rain, and we had, pancake breakfasts, mm-hmm. and, we had, dog shows, and, we really built this kind of cadre of people who were, like, totally dedicated to this place, to Armory Square. And what it ended up, what their original concept and our original concept was, is different than what you see today. In some ways. In some ways it's the same. But we never intended it to be an area which was so populated by bars and stuff like that. That was never the concept. But the reason that took place was because they were selling alcohol, and alcohol makes a lot of money.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they were able to pay the rent mm-hmm. and support the properties, and that's why that all took place. And retail operations had a much more difficult time, mm-hmm. Because they weren't selling a drug.
Yeah.
So it helps when you're selling drugs, so I think that's what happened. Now, I've always said this. I see this kind of in terms of a human lifespan, and these are developmental stages that these areas go through, and I don't think that we're finished developing yet. And I see some of that activity titrating at the present time. I really do. Some people don't, but I do, because
titrating?
Yeah, lessening. The impact of these bars.
Mm-hmm.
I sense mm-hmm. it's lessening a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, other people may not see this because it's still pretty wild, but I saw it when it was much wilder.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I really
mm-hmm.
did.
Mm-hmm.
And the key is establishing a code of behavior that is allowed on the street. you know, you can do anything you want when you're inside of a tavern, but when you step out onto the public street, then a certain code of behavior should be expected. I think that that code of behavior is becoming more defined today mm-hmm. than it was when we began, which mm-hmm. was like mm-hmm. it was like being in, you know, a Wild West town. You know, when you had like most of the buildings were empty and you had a couple of bars, you know, you walked out and it was like, you know, it was like being in the Wild West. So I think that's beginning to change, and I think it will change. I think we need to mature a bit, you mm-hmm. know, and I think we will as a city mature.
A lot of people live down there now.
People live down there, so and that's a very important element mm-hmm. to things. In that, you know, people will voice their concerns and go to their legislators and, you know, demand that certain changes be made. And mm-hmm. frankly, they have been made mm-hmm. in a lot of instances. They have been. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, I think that those kinds of places and a lot of young people. But the other thing that people don't understand about cities is that they focus on these kinds of behaviors, which you see in the paper sometimes and on the news. Mm-hmm. But no one takes account of the notion, which is in fact what is the reality, is that any area, any city has different activities during different times of the day. Mm-hmm. So that the activity that you will find in this place in the afternoon is different than the activity you will find there at 8 o'clock at night, and it's much different than you'll find at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
There is a changing level type of activity as the day progresses,
mm-hmm.
and that's just the way it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been in Athens, and there's a place called the Plaka.
Mm-hmm.
There's an area of the city called the Plaka, and you're right beneath the ruins of our civilization's history, right? Mm-hmm. And so you would want this to be kind of some kind of place that had some kind of importance, but mm-hmm. you know, when it hits 10 o'clock at night, it's like wild, you know, and. Yeah. And people are there cleaning up at 6 o'clock in the morning, but when the day begins, it's back to where it started, you know?
Yeah.
And it's kind of the same, I think it's the same thing. Yeah. And I think people don't realize that that's, in fact, the case. So they focus in on some of these behaviors that take place at 2 o'clock at night, and they make the leap and think that that's what it's all about all the time.
Yeah.
Well, it's not.
Yeah.
You know, when you go to the most, and the time that you go to the most, you don't see any of that.
No, it's a family place.
It's a family place.
In the morning,
that's right.
So stroll around, go into shops.
That's what people do not take account of.
Yeah.
And they
yeah.
see stuff on
yeah.
the media
yeah.
sensationalizes some
yeah.
of these things. And
yeah.
they don't say, well, this is only for a few hours of the day.
Yeah, yeah. yeah.
You can come here all the rest of the day and it's
mm-hmm.
not like this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They don't say that, you know, because it doesn't serve their interest. But
it reminds me a lot of a place in Brooklyn. There, you know, Farrell's Pub. It's kind of famous. It's right by Passaic Park. And
uh-huh.
We play Little League baseball in the field right next door, and
right.
then we'd have our Cub Scout outings. We'd
right.
even sleep out overnight.
Right.
But then Farrell's, at certain hours, right,
right.
after work,
right.
would be crowded with people drinking out of these cartons of green beer and stuff
yeah.
like that. And
yeah.
There was just such a timeliness to it. It was a very
Absolutely.
Temporal place.
And absolutely.
You could sell chocolate bars during the day, but you wouldn't go at night.
You've got it exactly
you know,
right.
It was,
you have it exactly right.
Yeah.
And that's exactly correct. You know? That's exactly the way it works.
Mm-hmm.
And but we haven't. I've got to write an article to that effect because
yeah.
people need to realize that.
Yeah.
And I think the people that frequent mm-hmm. there do realize it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just a whole bunch of other people who never come there.
Yeah.
Who
yeah.
get the impression that it's this wild and crazy place, 24
yeah.
hours a day.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
it's just not.
Yeah.
But you know, like I said, it's all about conduct. It's all about levels of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that people get addled by alcohol,
mm-hmm.
and they are really not in their right minds, and that's a different story. Those people should not be,
mm-hmm.
that should not be tolerated,
mm-hmm.
from my perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be tolerated. But I am absolutely convinced that unless somebody is psychotic
uh-huh.
or drunk, they are capable of understanding the rules of public behavior
mm-hmm.
and conforming to them,
mm-hmm.
and they do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They do, and that's why I it's very interesting. I take people talk about aggressive panhandling and stuff, mm-hmm. and I take a position against. I'm against that. And other people say, "Well, we should interfere with that." Blah blah blah. I have got a problem with that because I think that to allow that kind of behavior is really giving that individual a lack of respect. In that we are saying implicitly that person is not capable of learning the rules of society, and mm-hmm. I don't believe that. Mm-hmm. I think that people, when people hit the public street, when they walk mm-hmm. on the sidewalk, mm-hmm. that a level of conduct which is established by a norm that is established by the community, mm-hmm. it's in effect, and they need to conform. Yeah. They just do. And I think that if we expect that of everybody, unless they're psychotic, mm-hmm. which means mm-hmm. they don't know that they're in this world, mm-hmm. Or they're drunk, mm-hmm. They'll do it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They'll do it.
Were there things that you or other members of the sort of the armory committee that had the chicken barbecues and things did to bring about certain behaviors to sort of make certain things the norm? You said, you know, the shift from the Wild West.
Yeah. Well, they certainly have tried. Mm-hmm. And I think they did things like have these candlelight evenings, mm-hmm. which was a beautiful idea. It was mm-hmm. done by somebody by the name of Lynn Zimmer. She did this. Now, this was when, like, a lot of these buildings weren't there. Mm-hmm. Center Armory wasn't there. I built Center Armory, too, where Starbucks is. Mm-hmm. None of that was there, uh-huh. and it was a much different place.
It was a parking lot, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. But she had everybody put out these candles, mm-hmm. votives in these bags mm-hmm. with sand mm-hmm. at the bottom, mm-hmm. and it transformed the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It just transformed it. Mm-hmm. You know, it was almost like you were in church. Mm-hmm. You know, there mm-hmm. was a soft candle glow that mm-hmm. came out of these little mm-hmm. white bags, mm-hmm. And the harshness of this place, you mm-hmm. know, the broken at the time, the mm-hmm. some of the buildings, the broken buildings and whatever, mm-hmm. it kind of disappeared behind this stuff. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. And then they would have the orchestra, they would have the symphony play there, or they would have someone.
Oh yeah, I've seen that.
Stuff.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And it's quite beautiful. Yeah. It was very beautiful. Mm-hmm. Now it's more institutionalized, and it's still great. Mm-hmm. But when she did it, and when we did it at the time, it was. It was transformative. You know, mm-hmm, this place mm-hmm. became something different mm-hmm, mm-hmm. just by the addition of that mm-hmm. small element that mm-hmm. these lights mm-hmm. had been lit mm-hmm. all around, and they followed all the streets. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty magical. It really mm-hmm. was. It was pretty cool. Those kinds of things, you know, I think that kind of helps. You know, bringing in places like Starbucks and some of the retail places. Mm-hmm. Again, I think it's Frank. I think it's all mm-hmm. a matter of expectation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like when your children, they have, you know, you demand a certain, you mm-hmm. expect them to do certain things mm-hmm. and to live up to have a certain kind of behavior and to act. It's called socialization. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that yeah. I quite honestly think that we've been mm-hmm. in a process of socialization mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. in this area. Mm-hmm. I had somebody, mm-hmm. This was early on, these young guys, two young people, and he was urinating mm-hmm. on my building, right? Uh-huh. It was like 10 o'clock or something like that at night. And I went up to him. I didn't stand in front of him. I stood at a safe distance. But I went up to him. I said, "What the hell are you doing?"
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I said, "What are you doing?" I said, "You're peeing on my building." I said, "Where do you come from?" Uh-huh. "Fayetteville." I said, "Well, do you do this in Fayetteville?" "No." Uh-huh. I said, "Well, what makes you think that I want you to, you can do it here?" Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. that's not acceptable behavior. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, but that's exactly the point. Yeah. For him, for him, it was like nobody cared.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Well, I think that when you establish the fact that somebody cares, mm-hmm. and they tell you this is the way you got to act, mm-hmm. Either by word or by deed, mm-hmm. Then people get the idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Kind of like the reverse of the broken windows.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's the broken window theory.
Now, when I walk around, you're not there telling me, you know, saying,
right.
know, wait for the green light or right. whatever, you know.
Right.
But there are cues to me that this is a place that's a respectful place. The benches,
mm-hmm.
the bricks,
right.
the types of shops that are there,
right.
the you know the fact that there's a kids museum right across
right.
the street that
right.
That's well kept up and very clean, and
right.
these are things that show that people care.
Absolutely.
Was that intentional when you know who?
Absolutely. And mm-hmm. and George Curry and others put together the plan, the streetscape plan for
mm-hmm.
for
mm-hmm.
Armory Square, and
mm-hmm.
the city followed it.
Mm-hmm.
They're the one who developed that plan,
mm-hmm.
the pattern of bricks, the
mm-hmm.
lights,
mm-hmm.
all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That was done by George
mm-hmm.
and his
mm-hmm.
people. And yes, absolutely. And you know, Frank, this is a large part of what I teach. I try to teach. I don't know whether I do, but
mm-hmm.
I try to teach my class in urban studies is that the physical environment has a great mm-hmm. impact upon human interaction,
mm-hmm.
And a great impact upon about creating an atmosphere and a set of norms by which people,
mm-hmm.
you know, mm-hmm. who kind of governs people's behavior. That these physical forms
mm-hmm.
Translate
mm-hmm.
In people's minds. And it affects their it affects them emotionally
mm-hmm.
in really significant ways,
mm-hmm.
And I think that it's a very important point that shouldn't be lost.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And I spend a good deal of time in my class talking about this,
mm-hmm.
And I think you just hit upon it
mm-hmm.
when you said that
mm-hmm.
That these cues. Are exactly that's exactly right. They cue something
mm-hmm.
inside of you
mm-hmm.
that has you know caused you to have a certain reaction,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's critical.
Yeah.
You know,
well, for me, the mixed juice is an important part of that because as I'm walking along with the kids, I'm like, look, someone lives up there.
Right.
It's different from the mall. No one lives there.
No one lives there.
It's this big public,
right.
Well, not public place, but
right.
We won't get into that. But someone lives right there. This
right.
is someone's home. You
right.
you know, don't litter.
Right.
You're kidding. Someone lives right here.
Yeah.
You know? Not that you should litter anywhere else.
Right.
But there's an immediate...
absolutely.
Don't drop that. That's someone's house.
Yeah.
Someone lives there. And,
absolutely.
You know, they're right there.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
kind of a...
It's great. I mean, I think
yeah.
that's exactly right,
yeah.
you know. And, you know, the concept which... I mean, these are not my words, but you know, if you think of space as a container,
mm-hmm.
You know that which allows certain social activity to take place.
Yeah.
You know, that's I think a concept which people trying to design spaces in cities
mm-hmm.
have to keep in mind. And I do say to people that you know. If you want certain things to take place, certain activities to take place, certain interactions to take place, then, and this sounds ridiculously simple, you have to create a place where that can take, where that
mm-hmm.
can occur.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have the place, then it won't happen. And that's what people don't quite get sometimes,
mm-hmm.
is that you have to consciously create something. A physical space in order for certain activities to take place. And in the absence of that, then those activities don't take place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have a place to meet someone that you don't know, a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have a chance to look at somebody from your community that may be of a greater or lesser circumstance than you.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever, if there isn't a place to do that,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's another part of creating an urban space, which is so important, you know. And it's what suburban areas don't do.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't.
Yeah. Sort of a field of dreams if you build it.
Yeah. Yeah.
They'll enter.
I used that quote, by the way.
Do you really?
I used that when I was starting to do that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. When we first came out.
Well, that's very interesting. This resonates with me. I mean, one of the reasons I'm very interested in this is because I want to retire. My dream retirement is in an urban place. I remember in Brooklyn, people would sit on their street, on their stoops, and watch people walk by. I knew all the old people. I was a kid. I knew all the old people. It didn't bring me joy. Well, it made me feel safe.
Yeah.
It made me feel comfortable. Make me feel, you know, these older people are watching me as I walk home from school.
Right.
But it must have brought them quite, you know, they did it. They loved it.
Absolutely.
They would talk to people walking by, getting groceries.
Well, I'm building, I'm intending to build and planning to build a new place of residences in Columbus Circle
right
now. Mm-hmm. And that's the place I want to live.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and
beautiful.
It's the
mm-hmm.
it's the other, and I, you know, the people I'm talking with mm-hmm. about moving there, they feel the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that we're looking for a place, and we don't have to get in the car,
mm-hmm.
And that we can develop a community,
mm-hmm.
and we can get to know people there, and become close to them
mm-hmm.
socially,
mm-hmm.
And that we have things to do
yeah,
that when
yeah.
we walk out our door,
yeah.
you know, I have no. I'm not to anywhere near this point, but certainly, I don't want to reach a point, where my parents are right now,
mm-hmm.
Down in Florida, where they're captives in their home. They live in the suburbs, and they're
mm-hmm.
really not able to drive any longer.
Mm-hmm.
That's not my idea of a good time.
I hear this more and more, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know if you hear it a lot, but
oh, yeah.
people are, they're stuck in these air-conditioned.
It's really, really not a good existence. It
yeah.
really isn't.
Yeah.
It just isn't. I mean, you want to be able to walk out that door and get your own food and go to the get your drugstore stuff and all that jazz, but
yeah.
and be able to have the autonomy
mm-hmm.
to do it yourself and
yeah.
And not have to rely upon others yeah. to take you there.
Yeah. Yeah.
It just doesn't. And just doesn't resonate with me.
And sandwich generation people who are busy, worked and stressed out, and they're not there to take you there anyway.
I know.
They're working
That's
extra
right.
hours.
That's
and they,
right.
You know,
you're exactly right.
So, you know, I want to be respectful of your time. How? What? You did a bunch of educational things.
Mm-hmm.
What prepared you the most to do what you're doing?
Oh, well, gee.
I mean, does one need a law degree to do this? Does
no.
one need an MPA?
No.
Does one need a social degree?
I think a social degree helps a lot. I do.
I'm not pushing for that.
I know you're not pushing. I know you're not pushing. I tell people this all the time. I think that sociology is a great
mm-hmm.
degree.
Mm-hmm.
I really do.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a fantastic degree.
Mm-hmm. What would they do?
No, if I had to design an educational route, I would, you know, people are now teaching real estate development in colleges,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
so mm-hmm. you know you can be taught this stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You can be taught this stuff, and mm-hmm. Certainly a lot of developers come out of banks. And quite honestly, you know what, Frank?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of developers are second and third generation people. They are not people who are like me.
Mm-hmm.
They are people who, you know, regardless of how small their father or their grandfather might have started out, they were in the business. You know, they got a building that doesn't have a mortgage. They're getting X dollar. You know,
mm-hmm.
if you look, and particularly you're from New York City,
mm-hmm.
if you go to New York City and
yeah.
look at the major developers
yeah.
in New York City, they are all multi-generational.
Yeah.
Donald Trump doesn't talk about it very much, but Donald Trump, his father, was
mm-hmm.
a real estate developer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you look at around, their family, they're really, it's a family business.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it, and I understand why.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to, you know, except, I mean, I'm not a big developer.
Yeah.
But, you know, this stuff requires capital.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you either have to rely upon going out and getting the capital for somebody else,
mm-hmm.
but you know what? It's a hell of a lot better
mm-hmm.
if you've got the capital
yeah.
in your family account.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
That's why you see that. But in terms of my own education, I don't know. I mean, I think there's so many aspects of it that I'm not aware of that probably come into play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think, you know, but it's experience, and
mm-hmm.
a lot of it's experience, and a lot of it's come, you know, where I've made tons of mistakes,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, hopefully learned something from those mistakes. But in my case, I've read about other entrepreneurs, and this kind of thing is not unusual. My main purpose was not making money.
Mm-hmm.
that wasn't what I was about. Mm-hmm. And I've got the record to prove it. Mm-hmm. My wife will tell you that. Mm-hmm. That wasn't my main purpose. Mm-hmm. I did not say, I want to do this because I'm going to make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. I did it because I wanted to create something that I was really interested to see whether we could develop this idea of a community within a city. The idea that we could bring an urban aspect, an urban place to Syracuse, New York. That we could do something for the community. Those are the things that were driving mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. It really wasn't money. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have made mm-hmm. a lot more money in the last X number of years. Thankful, you know, I have. Mm-hmm. And that's been great for me, and mm-hmm. it's been great for my family. So, mm-hmm. but that wasn't why I did this when I started out.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, you know, my research isn't actually on entrepreneurship, it's on social entrepreneurship.
Uh-huh.
So what you're talking about is what
I don't think that what I did was that far away from social entrepreneurship at all.
Well, no, that's what I would call it. Do you want to give a definition of social entrepreneurship?
Well, I'd be hesitant to do that. Yeah. Although I don't know. I mean, in a very simple way, I think it would have to be that I think an aspect of it is it's a non-monetary focus, mm-hmm. and that it attempts at its core to better the community as a whole. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That it's something outside of yourself. Mm-hmm. That you're trying to do something that benefits others, and that's your primary focus, I think. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I don't know. But that's something off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was talking to my daughter about this, mm-hmm. and she was talking about, she works, and she does a lot of stuff with mentoring with high school students and stuff, but she has all these other ideas about things that she might want to do that would be important. And I said to her, you know, I said, here's the difference between social entrepreneurs and what you're talking about. Their ideas aren't any better than yours, talking to my daughter. They did it. Mm-hmm. And that's mm-hmm. what you've got to do. If you mm-hmm. want, mm-hmm. you know, that you have to make that mm-hmm. leap and say, "That's I'm going to do this."
Yeah. Is she in development too?
She's not. She works mm-hmm. for a company in Boston that does. Puts together mentoring programs for high schools.
Mm-hmm. Oh, neat.
Huh. Yeah, but she yeah. but she's got some other ideas about things. And she said, "Well, I think this could." I said, "You know what? It's that's up to you. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, mm-hmm. you're the one who's got to do mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. Nobody else can mm-hmm. do it."
Yeah. Yeah.
So. I think the similarity between entrepreneurship on one level and social entrepreneurship is the same, and that mm-hmm. is that, and it's the same thing I said before. It's those people who are able to take the action step, mm-hmm. who say to themselves, "I am willing to do whatever it takes." Mm-hmm. to affect my idea, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. whatever that is, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
I'm willing to do that.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what sets people apart mm-hmm, as mm-hmm. social entrepreneurs. And mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. I've listened to these guys and read about these guys, and it's like that fellow from, I think it was Brazil, who was determined to put a computer on the desk of all those kids, you know, mm-hmm. and that... he looked over... He didn't live that far from the barrio. He mm-hmm. looked over there and saw it mm-hmm. and said... What would it mean if we put a computer on the desk of every one of those kids? And he did it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, but it's you know, the critical aspect of it is what is when he went from a dreamer to being a social entrepreneur. Mm-hmm, 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 it was the action step. He got on a plane.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to America. Okay. Where are the computers?
Yeah,
they're in America.
Yeah.
That's where I'm going.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. No, definitely following that and doing it. So, so for students who would like to be social entrepreneurs, your advice?
Oh, my advice mm-hmm. is, I don't know if I, you know, I've spoken with people at the School of Entrepreneurism in SU.
Yeah,
I actually get asked this question all the time when I was there. A couple times I've been there, and it's very difficult to give advice. Uh-huh. on this, because it is such an individual, personal thing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It is so much has so much to do with what's inside of you, and your inner strength in that you are going to be willing to sacrifice, mm-hmm. that you're going to be willing to make a sacrifice, mm-hmm. which is always involved, whether it's a sacrifice of time, mm-hmm. money, or both, mm-hmm. whatever, that's what you're prepared to do. Now, I don't certainly think that, I mean, I certainly think that having a background which helps you understand the way the world works, mm-hmm. You've got to have some understanding of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got to understand certain things about finance and the way the world operates. I think you really should understand that.
How did you come about learning about, you know, finance and capital investment and
that was all amortization? That was all as a matter of, I just learned it as I went.
So you talked to someone who knew, or
yeah,
did you
and
read
just
it?
My internet, and I read, and I went, you know, mm-hmm. my interactions mm-hmm. with different people, and mm-hmm. I did some of it, and I think, and here we go, you know, I mean, come on, I mean, the law school course I took, the course I took at Maxwell School, I mean, you know, they may not have all been exactly on point, but a lot of them, mm-hmm. you know, had stuff to tell me, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and I'm sure that I picked up a lot of it from there, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know. And I think a lot of the specifics you can learn. You can learn, and you can study and pick it up mm-hmm. yourself, even. Mm-hmm. But you have to first have an understanding and awareness that you need to know that.
Right. Right.
You know, I need to know that stuff.
Right. Right. Right.
I got to learn that stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that a certain naivete is helpful mm-hmm. because people mm-hmm. who are experienced and knowledgeable, you know, people who are a bit naive to you, they don't fear to tread where others wouldn't
yeah,
go
yeah.
because they don't know any better.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
I
yeah.
think there's a certain aspect of naivety that is helpful.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
You don't want to be too wise because mm-hmm. then you're going to talk yourself out of things.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I think at some point I think that here's another quality that I think is really helpful. Mm-hmm. Your ability to identify people who are knowledgeable and who can help, and to be able to interact with those people and extract from them what mm-hmm. you need to know mm-hmm. in a respectful mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't mean like I'm going to get everything. You know. That kind of thing. I'm going to get everything I can from this guy. Mm-hmm. Not that, mm-hmm. but that person has experience and knowledge in something that you need to know and lack,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and you have the social skills, I guess, mm-hmm. to be able to go to those people and say mm-hmm. because you know,
yeah.
people want to help. They really want to help.
Yeah.
You know, nobody wants to go. Nobody wants to live 50 years, 60 years, uh-huh. and not be able to share their knowledge.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to do that.
The joy of knowledge. I mean, you don't have the whole thing until you're sharing it.
Absolutely.
It's just partial.
You want to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you want to
mm-hmm.
do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Super. Thanks.
Great.
This was very.